For more than 50 years, photographer David Plowden has been capturing images of America. And the land he loves the most is here in the Midwest. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'll talk with David Plowden today about his latest book, Heartland, The Plains and the Prairie, and a lifetime spent sharing what he sees. Then later in the hour, we'll talk about how the field of photography is changing, specifically photojournalism. I'll talk with Dennis Chamberlain, Associate Professor of Journalism at Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. For more than half a century, David Plowden's images have been teaching us things about our nation. His images have captured history as it passes and have made many of us stop and look at something ordinary in a new way. He has published many books of photographs and taught many students, including at the University of Iowa for a time. He now lives in Winnetka, Illinois, and his latest book is Heartland, The Plains and the Prairie. And he is with me today. Hello, David.
Hello, Charity.
Welcome back to the show.
Well, it's nice to be back.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And I want to go back to your childhood, because the Midwest is your home now, but it was not your home when you were growing up. You grew up in New York City?
That's right, New York City and Vermont, which is very different from the country out here.
Yes, very different. When did you first get a glimpse of this country?
Well, I first got a glimpse of this country way back in 1952 when I took a train west from Chicago and on my way to San Francisco. And I was, when we got a little west of Chicago, the country began to change. And very different from the landscape in New England. It was hilly, and where the sun went down at 4 o'clock in the afternoon behind a row of trees in our farm. And suddenly I realized, as I looked out the train window, my God, this is different. This is flat. You can see the sky. And I spent the night in Omaha and took a mail train the next morning.
Now, why were you on a mail train?
Well, I was on a mail train because I was supposed to go on one of the great limiteds, the Overland Limited, to San Francisco. But I went down on the platform, and there was a conductor of the mail train. And we started to talk, and he said, you know, if you want to see the country, ride with us. He said, you can stand on the back platform of the coach. There's only one coach on the train, and only employees, just the crew. He said, if you want to really see the country, come with us. We'll show it to you. So I did. And I stepped on board this mail train, which was just one rider coach at the end. And I did stand on the back platform. And as we left, went rolling across Nebraska, I was absolutely stricken, because here's the track going out right behind you and disappearing into infinity with grain elevators every 6 or 7, 8 miles. And I couldn't believe, I'd never seen country like this before. It's very different. You know, I grew up in New York where you can't see the sky. I mean, my bedroom window in the apartment in New York, I had to crane my neck and look up way, way up to catch a corner of the sky. All the buildings around us obliterated the sky. And I think, you know, I remember feeling this sense of freedom when I came out here. Oh, my God, you can breathe.
Well, you know, a lot of people have that experience of traveling across the country, of course, usually by car now. And if they've never been to this part of the country before, they get to Illinois and into Iowa and they see this vast expanse and this huge sky. And then they say, it's so boring.
I know. There's sort of the I-80 syndrome. When are we going to get there? Because everybody's, you know, it's really true. For years, I mean, you know as well as I do, I mean, people cross this country on the Overland Trail and everything else to get somewhere else. And I can't tell you the number of people I talk to who say, oh, well, I went through Iowa, you know, and I didn't see anything. You know, I have my father was English. And a lot of people would come from England, and they would fly to New York, and they'd fly to Washington, and they'd fly to Boston, and they might come to see us in Vermont. Then they'd fly over the country to San Francisco, fly home to England over the poles, the pole, and then a few days later, we'd get a letter from them saying how nice it had been to see America. Well, they hadn't seen America. They'd seen the 13 original colonies and the West Coast, but most of America lies in between. And I think for so many of us, we really don't, who don't live here, don't really understand the great beauty. I mean, certainly Walt Whitman understood it. Roger Louis Stevenson was absolutely overcome with the Nebraska landscape. He said it was like being at sea. And, I think people do equate often flatness with boringness. But, Wright Morris said when there's so much alike, which is everything looks alike, it makes you look very carefully at what's in front of you. And I think that certainly is true with me, because it's a flat landscape, therefore every single thing in that landscape is important.
So you were so taken with this landscape. Did you start telling other people about it? What kind of responses did you get from others?
I would tell them about it, and sometimes they were in disbelief. But one of my cousins did indeed he bought an old clunker of a car and drove from New York to San Francisco, took about 6 weeks, got back, and he said, you know something? I had no idea the breadth of America. I had no idea of who you are and why you are the way you are. I think I understand America now much better than I ever did. And I've always thought, people, if you talk about land, my land and all of that, I don't think you really know what you're talking about unless you come out here and be in the land. And I remember a farmer that I talked to out here, I forget, it was in Illinois or Iowa, who was talking to me one evening, and he was born in this, on the place 65 years ago. He hadn't moved, it had been his farm. And he was talking about the land, and he said, it's worth defending, isn't it? And I thought to myself, it's a double entendre here, He's talking about the land because his land is being encroached upon by all these housing developments. He's also talking about the land as a nation. And I think you get a very different feeling about the idea of land and what it's like to belong to the land and what land is when you're out here. I don't think you get that in the cities at all. And I certainly I've fallen in love with this country out here because I think, in a sense, it's the essence of America. And I also find it extremely beautiful.
David, last time we talked with each other, we talked about when you first started taking photographs. And for people who missed that conversation, which was a couple of years ago now, when was it that you became a photographer?
Well, I became a photographer, the first picture I made was when I was 11, of a train. And for the first, must have been 15 years of my life, I never photographed anything but steam locomotives.
And that's what we talked about last time you were here,
because
you published a collection of your steam locomotive
pictures.
And
that's what led me into photography. The idea of photographing the locomotive because it was disappearing. And that set in motion my whole career, which has always been photographing things that are disappearing, photographing the changes on the landscape, photographing all of the things that I have seen that are no longer here, and realizing that they were no longer here, going to be here, just the way I did when I was a kid, the locomotives. And so I learned from my friends in school who are very good photographers, one who studied with Minor White, with whom I later studied. They went out to visit Edward Weston. They knew the zone system backwards and forwards, Hessel's zone system. And they taught all this to me so I could go out and photograph black steam engines in the white zones of Vermont. And the person who was in charge of the photographic department in school said, well, Plowden's not serious enough. He only takes pictures of trains. And so my friends went to the head of the school and said to her, we'll shut down the darkroom unless Plowden's allowed to use it. And she said, well, if he loves things, if he loves locomotives, why shouldn't he photograph what he loves? And that was the end of that. I was allowed to be in the darkroom. But the important thing was, is of course, I photograph what I love. And when people tell me, oh, I'm just an amateur, I say, aha, well, then I am too, because I photograph what I love, and I'm passionate about it, passionate about the beauty of things and passionate about what I've seen in the horror of things. So my whole career has really been essentially documenting, or whatever you want to call it, the face of America. And obviously the Middle West, though it's changed, the landscape has changed drastically. I mean, the prairie is gone. The intrinsic nature of the land is still there. It is still a land under the sky. And we dwell on this wonderful little interface under the sky, my Lord. Everything out here is really dominated and controlled by what happens in the sky.
Well, and that makes photography very challenging out here as well. I mean, you write about the difference between the light in Vermont and the light in Iowa. And in your introduction to the book, you talk about how this light is untamed.
That's right. Raw light. And I had a friend who wanted to come out, and we persuaded him to come out. Another friend of mine and I, who loved this country, persuaded this fellow from New England to come on out and, you know, photograph out here. Love it. Wonderful. And he finally agreed. And I asked him how it went after he came back, and he said, I couldn't cope with the light. It was too much raw light. It was too much light. He was used to the gentle, quiet light of New England. It's very different. And I find the light out here is the whole, everything, well, of course, photography all depends on the light. But light playing on the land is what gives it its depth. It's what gives it its variety. It's the clouds and that play across the land the shadows and the highlights really make the photograph. And when you look at the sky, you see the sky, I mean, it's like mountains. And we're dependent on it. And the best light, to me, is before or after a tornado. I've been out there. In fact, there's one picture in the book that has a little funnel cloud in it, and I think probably overstayed my welcome. We got out of there in a hurry.
Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment.
I'm talking
with photographer David Plowden. He has published many books of photographs, and many of those photographs taken in the Midwest. His latest collection is called Heartland, The Plains and the Prairie. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is photographer David Plowden, and he has just published a new collection of photographs of the Midwest. His new collection is called Heartland, The Plains and the Prairie. And for more than 50 years, he has been taking pictures of the United States, many different images, moments of our history as it passes. In this collection, it's all about the land in Iowa, Illinois, and other states in the Midwest. And David, before the break, we were talking about our great big sky.
Yes.
and the raw light that it produces. What are some of the challenges? And let's talk specifically about Iowa. What are some of the challenges of trying to photograph the land in Iowa with this great big sky?
Well, the sky itself is obviously 90% of the photograph if you're doing the landscape. So if it's a dead, dull, cloudless sky, you make one kind of a photograph, a still photograph, and it can emphasize the emptiness of the land. If it's turbulent and wonderfully vital sky, then it makes the landscape look that way. And I think one of the most one of the great difficulties is when you're photographing the land out here is to try and give, you're dealing with essentially a two-dimensional landscape, right? So you're really trying to give depth. So you have to, in some way or another, give something in the foreground which anchors you and sort of puts you in the photograph, and then you need something in the background somewhere in the distance so that you have the illusion of standing in the foreground and looking at something in the distance so that you have the idea of perspective. I think that's the hardest thing of all, because when you're dealing with you know, landscape where there are mountains and there are lots of trees and things, you can, this is already an integral part of the landscape. But out here, where it's essentially, even though Iowa is not flat, everyone says it's dead flat, certainly it's not. You and I both know that.
Mm-hmm.
Kansas is much flatter, western Kansas, and very different. But you do need to have some way of seducing the viewer. And one of the things about the still photograph is that it makes you look at every single detail. And therefore, if you have a road, a section road, say, the gravel in the foreground of a section road is going to anchor you there. And you will see a light raking off the side. I mean, one of the things about photographing out here is in the evening, in the end of the day, the light is, of course, raking across the countryside and giving tremendous depth to everything. At high noon, it's the other way around. So if you want a picture that shows how essentially hot and how incredibly lonely it is, well, then shoot in the middle of the day. If you want to show the beauty of the landscape and show how much depth there is, do it in the evening. And I think one of the things that I have always felt about shooting in the evening is a slight digression, is that when the light is failing, you follow the light, and you look more and more carefully at the details because they're beginning to disappear. So you really tend to look into the photo, into the light. Now, the morning, I find it just the other way around. I find the light of the morning an imposition. I don't like it. I don't like a bright light morning. A foggy morning is great, but to me, the light of the morning blinds me.
Huh.
And in the evening, it makes me look. And I think one of the things that this landscape requires more than anything else in the world is for the photographer to look very carefully at every single detail, at all of the patterns of the light, all of the patterns of the plowing and of the field and of the grain and everything. It creates a whole pattern which we tend to overlook. And I think if the photographer has to look very carefully at all of those things in order to compose a photograph. And you can make a wheat field look absolutely magnificent. You can make a field of corn. And you can, in the spring, when everything's coming up, and you know, we have these little rows and rows and rows of soybeans. And it's a very beautiful design. When you also have a field which has almost been shorn after it's been harvested, if you get it with a soft light and the rolling hills of Iowa, it looks like the ocean.
Now, you work in black and white, and
yes,
of course, one of the things that so many of us love about Iowa and about the country in the Midwest are the amazing, vibrant colors that we have in the spring and in the summer and in the fall as well.
I know.
And you remove that element from your photographs.
I do. It's really true. When I'm photographing, I'm colorblind. I'm looking right outside my window today, and it's absolutely gorgeous, all kinds of beautiful yellows and reds and everything else in the trees. But when I'm photographing, I'm looking at the forms. I'm looking at the light and the shadow and the form of things. It's in other words, composing things by the elements that are there. And I really, truly don't see, it's honestly true, I don't see the color. And I am looking at the shapes.
So what, when you take a photograph of a vibrantly green field, and that might be the main thing that any of us would see if we were looking at this scene that you're shooting.
Yes.
So what do you feel you can communicate to me as a person who looks at the photo through the photograph that I couldn't see if I were there in real life?
That's a hard question. I think it's a matter of composing the lines that I see in the fields. Also, if you look at a field of soybeans in August, and you watch the wind blow across the field, look at the leaves rippling. It's like the ocean, like a lake. It really is. And if you look at the way the corn is planted in lines, you get the light raking across it, it makes the most beautiful pattern. And to me, this is a much more interesting, it's all man-made. And I did a book called The Hand of Man on America. We have created a man-made landscape out here, which a lot of people say, we've destroyed it. We haven't. I don't think we have at all. I think we made a very beautiful landscape. And I think the farming landscape and all of those beautiful lines of the crops themselves are extremely interesting. And then you've got the sky playing on top of this. You have the architecture of light to deal with. And that's probably one of the best expressions I could use. You know, light creates its own architecture, shadows and highlights, and it emphasizes all kinds of things that you probably wouldn't look at carefully if you were overwhelmed by the mountains or overwhelmed by the color of the trees. I don't look at those things. Now, I have to be very honest with you. I like the trees bare rather than with leaves, because you can see the actual form of the tree. You can almost sense it's being. You can sense it's a live being. And so, when I'm photographing things, remember, I also photograph things, a great deal of architecture and a great many things which are disappearing. And long ago, I mean, color film did not last. Kodachrome did, but the other color films didn't last. And I was trying to make a record of these things that would last, and so I did indeed use black and white because I could control it and I could develop it properly. This all changed today, mm-hmm. completely, as you well know.
I mean, so you were making pictures that could last forever.
Yes, and in the darkroom, I mean, you had to wash it, and make the silver stable by treating it with selenium. You know, all of these things, but, you know, I'm really talking about this archivalness, you know, in 100 years from now, we have no idea whether these are going to survive or not. We do know that photographs that were taken in the 19th century have survived because the people who made them were very careful. They used the right chemicals. But we've lost a whole generation of people who shot weddings and all kinds of family events in color. Mm-hmm. They've disappeared.
I'm talking with photographer David Plowden. His latest collection is called Heartland, the Plains and the Prairie. And David, I want to talk about grain bins. Because clearly these are structures that you have a lot of affection for.
I do.
Tell me how your love affair with grain bins began.
Well, they're unique to this part of the country. I mean, in Vermont, you have the White Clapboard Church, you know, and... Well, you have the pyramids in Egypt, and you have out here these incredible structures that are on the land. And you're driving along, and you'll come to a town, and there's a grain elevator. My gosh, you look ahead, and 5, 6, 7, 8 miles, there's another one. And each, no matter what size the town is, the grain elevator gives it identity. It's like having its own little skyscraper. And to me, there are fascinating punctuations in the land. They really are when you look at it. And I find that not only are they representative, obviously, of the land being the containers of the grain, but they're fascinating architecture.
They're they're something that we take completely for granted. They are a tool, of course, to farmers. And they are structures that, although, I mean, they are striking. You can't help but notice that they're there. We haven't done anything creatively with them, it seems. I mean, people don't tend to make an effort to make them beautiful.
No, but in a sense, that's why they are. And Corbusier, the great architect, he said the American grain elevators and factories are the magnificent first fruits of a new age. The American engineers, overwhelmed with their calculations, are expiring architecture. He was deeply impressed by the fact that these engineering, these plain, simple, unadorned buildings were really magnificent in themselves. And I think I've felt the same way. Nobody's trying to make a grain elevator a cathedral or a town hall or anything, and yet it is a sort of the town hall. It's the center of the town when you think about it. And yes, people do take it for granted. I remember talking to a farmer in Dysart when I was photographing, and he was asking me why I was photographing the grain elevator. And I said, well, it's the most important building in town. Look at it. It's the tallest building in town. And I said, Matt, don't you come here to do business? He said, yes. So I said, in a sense, it's the center of commerce of the town. And I said, where I come from, we don't have them. So to me, this is a unique emblem, an icon of this part of the country, even though it's all taken for granted. And he looked at me, and he looked at the grain elevator. He said, I'll never look at it the same way again. You're right. It is the most important building in town. And I think that's because, to me, they represent this country out here. And because where I grew up, we didn't have them. So I came out here and saw these magnificent things out here as emblems of the country. I was stricken with them. I really am. Now, when I was doing this book, I felt I had a license to photograph, quite literally. And they are beautiful. They really are beautiful structures. And the old, wonderful old frame peak roof ones are disappearing. But even the great, huge, new concrete ones have a majesty about them. A simple, unadorned work of engineering. They're like a bridge in that sense.
Well, your pictures in this collection are absolutely stunning. And I admit that I guess maybe I'm a sucker for the excitement of a storm front. The ones with the storm fronts are my favorites. But can you give us an idea, and you write a little bit about this in your introduction, an idea of how many pictures and how much time you've spent trying to capture the essence of the Midwest?
Oh, God, years. I first started doing it in 1964. A lot of the photographs in this book were done in this century. And I have traveled back and forth across this country. I have no idea how many thousands, maybe tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of miles, trying to find the place where everything came together. I mean, when you're dealing with a landscape, when you're dealing with clouds, when you're dealing with things that change every minute, you see, everything is there. Oh, it's wonderful. And yet, there's a bush in the wrong place or a car pulls up in the wrong place. The amount of time spent out here to find the photograph, I mean, some days I will drive literally 200 miles and find nothing. What I like to do is sort of hunker down in a place, and my wife and I will stay there, and then we'll search that area. And I often try, for instance, in Iowa, thank heaven I was working with Humanities Iowa, who's Chris Rossi, who has helped me in every way possible, to find places to go. And I would sit down in Greene County for 10 days and photograph, and I would go to other places and photograph and explore. When I was doing Kansas, I would be driving for miles and miles and miles looking. And it's all a matter of finding the moment when everything comes together, because there's no such thing as a 99% photograph in my book. I mean, in my life. Everything has to work. And it's a tremendous chance when you're out there to find a place where you can use that beautiful light, where there's something to photograph. And it's very hard because you drive and drive and drive. You may know what you're looking for. You may know what you want, but it has to materialize in front of the camera before you can make it. You can't make it up and you can't preconceive it. You have to find it, and it has to exist, and it only exists for that moment.
And you estimate that you've taken over 15 miles of film?
I think that's what one of my assistants and I counted it up one day. We figured, oh, my gosh, it must come to about that. But listen, that's 15 miles. There might be a quarter of a mile of worthwhile photographs in there, or maybe even less. There's a tremendous amount of film shot.
Right. You've created some truly, truly memorable images. And, David, we're out of time, but thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you. Nice to talk to you again. It really is. A great pleasure. Thank you.
David Plowden, photographer. His most recent collection is Heartland, The Plains and the Prairie. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about how photography is changing and specifically how photojournalism is changing because of all of the new advances in photographic technology. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Photographic technology has been changing very rapidly ever since digital photography became a reality. Now, everyone has a camera with them at all times, and that has changed the world of photojournalism. Dennis Chamberlain is Associate Professor of Journalism at the Greenlee School of Journalism at Iowa State University. Hello, Dennis.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm pleased to join you.
And the world of photojournalism has changed in a lot of ways. In some ways, digital technology has given photojournalists an incredible tool, amazing things that they can do that they couldn't have done before, right?
Yeah, that's true. Some of it is for the good, and I also have to admit that sometimes I think it kind of hinders us in what we can do. There's a sense of that we have to file things immediately, and it doesn't give photojournalists sometimes the time to really look at what's going on around them because they're thinking about getting the first images back to the office or posted up on the internet. So sometimes that can be a downside, but the good side is we've got these sensors now that are incredible in their quality, and we have cameras that can be smaller, lighter, quieter. So we've got a lot more tools that we can use now.
These days, everybody thinks that they are a photographer. As someone who trains people who are going to be photojournalists, what kind of training do you recommend somebody get with a camera these days?
I think probably if you're going to be a photojournalist, the best training is actually a broader education and not just simply you need to learn how to use the tools that you have. And whatever tool that you happen to have handy is going to be the one that's best for you. But I think you need to understand the world around you because when it comes down to it, whether you have a $5,000 camera or a smartphone or a point-and-shoot, they're just tools. What really matters is how you see the world and how you use that tool to capture what you're trying to say.
We are at this moment of tremendous change, and I want to revisit a time of tremendous change that came before, and this is long before digital technology, but let's talk about the Brownie camera, and when all of a sudden, that's the first time that everybody really felt that they could be photographers, right?
That's true. I think that when George Eastman introduced the Brownie into the market, and for the first time, you didn't have to be a serious amateur with practically a chemist yourself in order to practice photography, you could buy this box, push the button, you know, point it at your friends, loved ones, street scenes, and landscapes, and send it off to Kodak, and they'd process it and send you back a reloaded camera with the photos that you'd made. And it was like this wave of people hitting the streets. That's when the term snapshot was coined. And serious photographers, I think, actually reacted against that. And there was a movement of the art in art photography especially, to actually try to become more like painting. And a lot of photographers, if you look at work from that time, you'll see images where you can actually see the brush strokes from the emulsion that was painted onto the paper. And it's like if you were going to be a serious photographer, you had to distance yourself from the man in the street who was making photographs.
So technology was pushed forward in two senses, because, of course, the artistic and serious photographers wanted to push it farther so that they could do more with the images they were trying to create. But, of course, the rest of us wanted better pictures of our families.
That's correct. And actually, I think that's probably kind of what's still going on today. I mean, a lot of people, even more so, I think, you know, people are making photographs of themselves a lot with their smartphones.
Yes.
And, you know, maybe that's just a fad right now and it'll change. But I think even today, serious photography or serious art photography still tries to distance itself from that. And at least a lot of artists do by having huge, huge prints, things that the amateur couldn't afford. I've been to... My graduate degree is in fine art photography, and when I was in school about 7 years ago, I remember being struck by the fact that, you know, as a photojournalist, my purpose was always to get the best possible photograph that summed up the scene as small as I could or as fast as I could and get it published. And then all of a sudden, when I started to work in the art world, it was about making bigger prints. Something where actually it would set the art photographer apart a little bit sometimes, just because the scale was so huge compared to what the amateur was doing.
Well, now, of course, with this camera in everybody's pocket, when something happens and people are around, people take pictures and they post them on Facebook and they post them on Instagram. And the pictures of something happening, some piece of news occurring at that moment. I mean, those are compelling photographs, even if they're not good photographs.
Well, yeah, sometimes they are. I mean, I can think of a situation, it was maybe about 6 months ago, where it was a video, there was a dashboard camera, and this was in Russia, and a truck, a huge lorry, had run a red light and ran into a bus. And it was this riveting piece of video that just because some car that was going by had a dashboard camera captured. But on the other hand, let's say 2 days ago here on our campus in Iowa State, we had a big news event and I wandered over there. My building wasn't too far away. And
you're talking about the young man who drove his pickup truck onto campus and then was killed by police officers.
That's correct. And by the time I arrived there, there were, you know, a good sized group of students. Everybody had their smartphones out. They were all making photographs. They were shooting videos. And I know a lot of that stuff went up on Twitter. There were things on Facebook. The Daily Student or the Iowa Daily Student had a lot of their photographers there. And I don't know how many of the images were actually riveting, because most of the images that I saw that were going up on social media and places like that, they're pictures of things. And photojournalism isn't about things. It's about people, and it's about how people react to something that's happened in front of them, whether it is a tragedy, whether it's something that's joyful. And I think a lot of the times the people that aren't trained, and actually they're not schooled, they're not thinking about looking for how people react. And so we end up with a lot of images. You know, some of the images that I saw from this event were pictures of the tire marks in the grass, pictures of broken display for homecoming, pictures of police cars, lots of pictures of police cars. And that doesn't really say a lot. And, you know, a photojournalist, the first thing they're going to do when they get on the scene is look how people are reacting. You know, when by the time I arrived, I noticed administrators running across campus. And it's not too often you see university administrators in their suits running across the field. And, you know, so for me, that was the kind of thing to point the camera towards. Also noticed right away that the emergency personnel looked really, they were working really hard. And so just the expressions on their face said an awful lot. So it's the kind of thing that... even though we all have cameras, you have to be thinking about what you want to point them at and what you're trying to capture.
Now, we've had a number of events in recent history where corporations have decided that they don't need photojournalists, or at least highly paid photojournalists, or even well-paid photojournalists.
Yeah.
And a wonderful example of that is the Chicago Sun-Times made the decision to lay off their photojournalists on staff. And there is this stark example of how that affects the coverage of an event. And that was when the Stanley Cup was brought back to Chicago. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the images that we saw from that event and how we can compare images taken by photojournalists and images not taken by trained photojournalists in that event?
Yeah. The Chicago Tribune, which happened to keep their photo staff, had incredible, really striking images from fans celebrating. Actually stuff with the trophy when it's back. On the other hand, the Chicago Sun-Times was running photographs, and I remember one that I saw that was on the front page. It basically looked like a snapshot that somebody would have taken from Facebook. And, you know, it's interesting. It's probably great for the person that's in that photo. Oh, I'm on the front page of the newspaper. But it wasn't necessarily it's an image that already isn't in my memory. I mean, it's hard for me to – I wouldn't be able to describe it anymore. You know, but the one in the Chicago Tribune was really, you know, clean, a lot of emotion. And I think that's, you know, when you're trying to grab people's attention, you really need to be thinking about how you're going to, you know, we're exposed to so many images in any given 24-hour period that we're going to need ones that have emotion or striking or beautiful light, something like that that's going to keep our attention for more than 5 seconds. And generally speaking, a trained photojournalist or a trained photographer is going to be more capable of that than somebody who just happens to pick up their phone and snap a shot.
So when the photojournalists were laid off at the Chicago Sun-Times, and this has been happening at a lot of newspapers around the country and around the world, you know, there are people who come down on both sides of the issue. And there are people who out there who are saying, you know, with the fact that everybody has a camera in their pocket and everybody at a protest that's taking place, you know, in the Arab Spring, they have cameras in their pockets and they're capturing history as it happens. And we have this kind of image access that we just have never had before. There are people who say that, you know, this is a very exciting time for photography, and some of the most indelible images are going to be captured by people who are not trained photographers. How do you feel when you hear people make that argument?
I think that that's possible. I mean, because throughout history, there have always been really wonderful photographs that were made by people who weren't professional photographers. It's just right now I feel that we are kind of swamped by a sea of images, and a lot of them probably aren't that good of quality, and it's hard to kind of sift through them and figure out which ones are the pearls. And, you know, I think I wouldn't say that professional photographers should have a monopoly on using a camera. That's absolutely crazy. But I also think that if you had a publication or if you're, you know, a media company, you are going to want people who get solid results on a regular basis rather than someone who makes one nice photograph every few years. And that, I think that's what it comes down to. It comes down to being able to consistently produce something that communicates the intended message. Because, you know, cameras are pretty easy to use now compared to the old days, but in some ways they're even more complicated because there's so many choices, the controls, and actually my dream is to be able to have a digital camera as easy to use as an old film camera. That would be, it would make my life much easier teaching photography too.
Do you see a growing divide between the publications who are willing to pay photographers and the publications who are not?
I think in the quality of the work that you see there, yes. Especially when publications are paying are actually a lot of times now they're saying, we can't afford to pay for photography, but we'll give you a credit. Mm-hmm. And that's always been the case, but it seems like that's more and more places are using that. They think it's an honor for you to have your picture published. And those are the places that are not going to get the top of the line, the very accomplished photographers to work for them. It's, you know, if you've got to make a living, no writer is going to give away their work for free. And, you know, actors are not going to appear in movies for free either. You know, you have to pay for a quality product if you want it.
Now, of course, with more and more people turning to the web for news, of course, it's a great place for photographs, but also it's a great place for video as well. How is the push for compelling videos changing the life of photojournalists?
Radically. And actually, sometimes I wish I was 20 years old again, because I think video is the future for most photojournalists. I push my students to spend more time working on video. They say, oh, but I want to be a still photographer. No, there's no such thing as a still photojournalist anymore. You have to be able to do both. And if you're a reporter, you also need to know how to do both. I mean, some of the best video that I've seen coming from students in the last few years are people who consider themselves essentially word people. Or maybe really good photographers who weren't interested in video whatsoever. And when they sit down and they push the button on their camera to start shooting video, I think they belong in film school because they understand how to weave a story together from separate still images, moving images, audio. And I think it's really exciting time.
This sounds like the thing that is firing your imagination the most right now.
Oh, it is. I love audio too. And so if I was going to be, start my career over, I would probably concentrate a lot more on audio, and video would definitely be a part of it. But, you know, that didn't exist when I started 25 years ago.
So do you see that as the area where we're going to see the most growth?
Yeah, I think so. I think we have a fascination. And actually, the thing that's best about it is that still photography does a great job of describing things, but it doesn't do a good job of explaining. It suggests meanings. And when you can add audio, and especially if you can add audio of the subject who you're making images of, or you can add moving images and audio, it just adds all these other layers of meaning and explanation to the package that I think it's a more complete journalistic story.
Dennis, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Dennis Chamberlain is Associate Professor of Journalism at the Greenlee School of Journalism at Iowa State University. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And with me in the studio now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Charity.
What's coming up on the show today?
That's the question I was waiting for. No, of course, at noon, it's politics day because it's Wednesday. And, of course, we're going to dig through the results of yesterday's, I guess what they're saying is an off election here in Iowa. For instance, we'll look at why the Koch brothers poured some $30 million into a campaign to defeat some incumbents on Coralville's city council. Also, the national results, election in Virginia as well as New Jersey, as bellwethers for 2014 and 2016. Our analysts, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa.
This election's over, so now we can start the next one, right?
Oh, we're already to 2016, Charity. Come on.
Thank you for that's coming up today on River to River. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Neppe.